Welcome. You're listening to No Lasting City, probably the second best podcast in the world. I'm Matthew Johnston, and with me today is Andrew Young and Young Toby. This podcast is a ministry of Riverbend Bible Church here in Hastings, New Zealand, and our goal is to distract you from the mundane and to ravish your minds with the glory of God manifested in the person and work of Jesus Christ. Our guest today is our dear friend back once again. I believe this is his third or fourth time with us here on No Lasting City. We're so glad that Dr. James Dolezal is here with us. James is a professor of theology in the School of Divinity at Cairn University. He also serves as visiting professor of theology at the IRBS Seminary in Mansfield, Texas. James is the author of several books, one being God Without Parts and All That Is in God. He's contributed to several volumes, including Divine Impassibility and Classical Theism. And prior to teaching at Cairn, Dr. Dolezal served as a pastor in Alberta, Canada, and a research fellow in the Craig Center at Westminster Theological Seminary. So we are blessed beyond all measure to have James with us today. James, greetings. It's lovely to see you again.
Gentlemen, it's great to be with you again.
We have the best time when James joins us, and we get so much wonderful feedback from each of the podcasts we have with you, James. And so it's been a little while since we've done a podcast all together here, and so it's exciting to be here for episode number 24 on No Lasting City. Our conversation today will center around transcendence and immanence. And so, James, we want to hand it over to you just to tell us and the listeners what is meant by transcendence and immanence.
These are two ways of describing God's relationship to the world, and they both have a different sense, though I want to emphasize right up front that we're not really talking about two different things. We're talking about the same relationship of God to the world in two different ways. Maybe that's the first thing we should say. His transcendence very simply just gets at his beyondness, that God exceeds the world. That's the word that is often used by medieval theologians and Reformed theologians, that God exceeds the world. You think of a text like Psalm 113, verse 4, the Lord is high above all nations, his glory is above the heavens. And so if you think of the heavens, these are the heights of his handiwork, the most resplendent of his handiwork, and yet his glory is greater than the most glorious realm of manifested glory. So there's this superlative beyondness. Compared to the world, God exceeds it by an infinite degree. At the same moment, as God is beyond the world, he also fills heaven and earth. We think of a text like Jeremiah 23:23-24, "Do not I fill heaven and earth, declares the Lord," so that there is no realm or dimension within the created realm where God is not fully present in the fullness of his being. And so with transcendence, we're saying that God's being exceeds the world perfectly and infinitely. And with immanence, we're saying that the presence of God's being suffuses and fills the world to repletion. And we're saying both of these things at once so as not to play the one off against the other. Even though they are different conceptually, they aren't different really. They're just two ways of characterizing God's relationship to the world. And maybe just on that note, we should observe that historically, theologians describe transcendence and immanence as relative attributes or relative properties. And by that, they just simply mean these are things that we say about God relative to creatures, so that hypothetically, if there's no creation, there's no such thing as transcendence and immanence because there's nothing that God exceeds. He certainly doesn't exceed himself. And the question of immanence is pretty much moot if there's no creation to which he would be present. So these are things that we say about God that are true of him in virtue of his being and in virtue of his universal act of creation. This is what establishes this relationship. But transcendence and immanence are said relatively, so that God isn't self-transcending, and immanence isn't usually a way we describe God's own relationship to himself, unless we're talking about the co-inherence of the persons in the Trinity. But that would be a somewhat exotic use of the term immanent and not normally how it's used in theology.
That's really, really helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, James, how does, I mean, so that's the concept of transcendence, immanence, and that's obviously in the background of our mind. How does it, why does it matter to us? How does it play out in theology? There's so many broad, I guess, doctrines that we'd consider. If, for example, we were to get transcendence and immanence wrong, or one rather than the other, how would that sort of play out practically in the different ways people understand God and his relation to the world?
Well, let's start with transcendence first and say that if you have a transcendence that is a beyondness conceived as remoteness, then you might have a difficulty. You most certainly have a difficulty because God would be beyond and therefore far off. And he even asked the question in Scripture, am I a God who is far off? It's rhetorical, and the answer is supposed to be no, he's not far off. But if your view of transcendence, if your view of beyondness is that this is referring to some kind of distance that necessarily removes God from the world, that would be a problem. A transcendence that banishes God from his own creation is something more akin to deism than it is to biblical Christianity. That would be one challenge. I think on the other side, if your view of immanence is such that if he's near to me, he's got to be near to me the way that other immanent things are near to me. So you and I mean, now as we're having this conversation, I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and you're in New Zealand, and you're in the month of December, I think, and I'm in the month of November, and yet somehow traversing time and space, the internet has brought us near to each other audibly and visually. And yet there's a certain incompleteness about this. Like there's a negotiated relationship. You three are in the same room. I'm half a planet away from you as we're having this conversation. And sometimes the temptation might be to think that God's immanence, in a certain sense, has to sort of negotiate space and a spatial relationship the same way that we do with each other, so that if he's near us, then he can't be. If I'm going to be near my family in Philadelphia, then I can't be near you guys in New Zealand, and therefore I've got to sort of remotely or virtually connect with you. The question is with regard to God's immanence. Is his immanence, is his nearness, in a certain sense, restricted or circumscribed in the ways that our nearness is? And this is the question. Does God fill heaven and earth as one of the occupants of heaven and earth? And I would submit that that's actually a wrong way to understand immanence, that his presence is not like the presence of one finite creature to another in time and in space. While he's near us in time and in space, he's not near us as a temporal being or as a spatial being. So maybe that would be one thing that would be at least a yellow flag theologically to say, before you start going down the route of characterizing God's immanence, there are certain ways you would not want to exegete that. You wouldn't want to exegete it as bound in time and in space, or as negotiating room for himself in a world of spatial entities or temporal entities. So however he's going to be near us, it's not going to be the way that other creatures are near us. Maybe these are just sort of pitfalls to look out for on the front end. And I think one way to, in a certain sense, to avoid those pitfalls, we have to dig down into the roots of what is it, what action, if I said these are relative things that we say of God, then what exactly is the relation, the character of the relation, and particularly on the divine side, what is the action of God that establishes this relation that is at once transcendent and immanent? And at this point, there's really one answer that we should give to this with regard to transcendence and immanence, and it is the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, that God is the absolute immediate cause of all that exists, and that he's not like a deist God who sort of gives the world a shove and sends it spinning on its way and maybe occasionally shows up and intervenes. But for the most part, he gets it going, and then he, as it were, steps back from it. But in so much as the world, living things live, move, and have their being in and from him, and as much as we receive all things from him, life, breath, and all things, I'm thinking here of Paul's words in Acts 17, then there's a real sense in which God is near us in the very act that establishes his transcendence, which is creation. Absolute creatorhood, absolute cause of being is what establishes his relation as infinitely transcendent to ours. And yet it's also that exact same action of creation and sustaining that establishes his nearness. The very act that establishes him as the transcendent one is also the act that establishes his relation as the immanent one. He's immanent in his transcendent, and he's transcendent in his immanence. And this is not to cancel out the conceptual distinction of both of those terms, but just simply to say they're both grounded on the exact same relationship of creatures to God, which is that of creation and sustenance. So maybe these are some ways to just begin to say, maybe put it this way. I think sometimes the temptation is to say, God is transcendent as if transcendent is a problem that needs to be solved, right? And you come across this, I think even a lot of conservative theologies in recent years treat transcendence as a problem to be solved. Transcendence means that God is far away, and this is how it often sounds in Christian conversation. God is transcendent, and then a statement similar to this, but thankfully, he's also immanent. As if immanence is, in a certain sense, offsetting a dilemma that transcendence places before us. And what I want to propose is that these are not actually different properties that are mutually conditioning each other, offsetting liabilities on either side. They are, in fact, exactly the same relationship, God as creator, conceived in two conceptually distinct ways. His beyondness as creator and his immanence as creator. So that if it's the exact same relationship that establishes transcendence and immanence, then it's not quite right to think of immanence as correcting the distance problem of transcendence. It actually is more mysterious than this. It's the transcendence that actually enables God to be so immanent. So that if he weren't absolutely transcendent, then he would have to be negotiating his immanence the way that a finite entity would negotiate its own nearness to us. So, you know, you guys, if Toby and Matthew go out to lunch and you go to a little restaurant and you decide where you're going to sit and you both kind of go for the same seat on the same side of the table, somebody's going to have to step aside. I don't know how it works with you guys and, you know.
I would gladly step aside for Toby to get the better seat. I'm so okay, humble.
So Toby gets the seat. So Matthew's got to step aside. And there's a certain sense in which Toby cannot be perfectly present to Matthew. There's a certain necessary distance given the finitude both of Matthew and Toby. So that if God is not absolutely transcendent, then his immanence would have to be like the negotiated immanence of a finite being. And I guess what I want to say is, if he's not perfectly transcendent, then he can't be so near to us. It's the very thing that establishes his absolute transcendence, creatorhood, that is also the very ground of his perfect interior immanence to us. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but we're talking about creation.
Great. It's really great.
Well, I guess in my mind, I've more heard it explained in a sense that the transcendence and immanence are in opposition to each other. As if they're these different things, you know, like God is so near, but that's a problem because God is so above and distinct. And as if, but you've presented it in a way where it's a little more nuanced than just this hard tension, I guess.
And stranger. I mean, yeah. I think the biblical doctrine of creation establishing both transcendence and immanence at once is in fact a stranger and more unfamiliar reality to us than this idea of a transcendence that's negotiated by an immanence, or that is sort of corrected by an immanence. But I think the problem with that kind of polar opposite is if these are mutually exclusive ways of being. I think that's basically due to the fact that we're interpreting the term transcendence the way that we interpret transcendence among creatures, so that we can talk about. I think of when Elihu talks to Job in Job 35, and he says, look at the heavens, or look at the clouds, they are higher than you. And so, and he makes this whole point about a relative transcendence within the created order itself, yeah, in which the clouds are above us. And his point in that context is, you don't benefit the clouds, but the clouds benefit you. They give you shade, they give you rain, but what do you give them? And there's a certain kind of excellency in which they provide for you, but you don't provide for them. And there's a relative transcendence. But also at the same time, there's a kind of, that transcendence also has baked into it, so to speak, a remoteness, a distance. So that if those clouds are going to be really near you, they're going to have to sort of fall down to the ground as fog, and then you're not going to so much get the same benefit as you would of the shade or of the rain that falls, something like that. Something's got to give to negotiate the nearness. Either the transcendence has got to go and the clouds aren't way up in the sky and they're with me, or they're way up in the sky and they're not with me. And so how do I, if we have this kind of relative transcendence as opposed to an absolute transcendence, then we will need some kind of immanence as a corrective to the transcendence. But if it's the transcendence of the Creator, who is transcendent as the one who, from the infinite fullness of his being, gives the act of existence to all things, thereby establishing his infinite transcendence over those things as their absolute cause of being, and if that also is the very means by which he is near to them with perfect interiority, that is to say, he's as near to you as the very act of existence by which you are, which is to say, he couldn't be nearer. If the very thing that is the establishment of his sublime transcendence is also that which establishes his nearness, then we're not really talking about we're not talking about something in God that corrects something else in God, in that respect. But we're really just talking about an immanence that is grounded on transcendence, and a transcendence that establishes immanence.
Do you think a lot of people struggle with, if you sort of made a difference between two types of transcendence? You can conceive of it as, you know, within the creation, and then there's a transcendence where you're like, no, in a whole separate category above and beyond creation. And it's as if so many Christians live in that world where they only think of it, a God that's higher in degree of created things, rather than, like you said, that absolute transcendence. And does that tie into people struggle, I guess, with trying to understand classical theism, and how does that all tie in together?
I think generally you're describing an effect of what we might call univocism, or univocal thinking about God. So that if I use a word like I can use the word transcendent, and I can say, I can use this to describe superior things among creatures. So I can say, Dostoevsky is his literature, transcends, Dr. Seuss or something like that. I mean, I could make some kind of compare, or Christian romance novels. No insult for the lovers of Christian romance novels, but Dostoevsky's better literature. And I think that can be demonstrated. And you could even talk about a kind of literary transcendence. And you could do the same thing with regard to athletic ability. Any hierarchical distinction that you can make among creatures that you can measure and quantify by some standard, but also which is commensurable, which is to say, there is a measure between the author of a Christian romance novel and Dostoevsky. While they seem to be pretty far apart in terms of like lowbrow literary and pretty sophisticated literature, while there may be a great distance literarily between them, it's not an unbridgeable distance. It's a commensurable distance. That is to say, it's a transcendence, but it's a transcendence that can in fact be, in a certain sense, measured, quantified, yea, even overcome by creaturely effort and means. And so when we're talking, and I think the temptation is to take, Andrew, the temptation is to take these commensurable kinds of transcendence and then try to fit the God-world relation into something like that, which is exactly why, when you do that, it's exactly why suddenly you need some mechanism to overcome the transcendence problem, because in a creature, let's put it this way, let's just take spatial entities. The very thing by which something spatially transcends or exceeds another, creates a remove or a distance from that thing. So if you just like take the top of the Eiffel Tower, and you stand on the ground there at the Seine, and you're looking up at the top of the Eiffel Tower from the riverside, and you see it. Many years ago, I visited it, and when I first showed up, I was going to go up the tower, and the top of the tower actually disappeared into the clouds. There were low-hanging clouds, and you could see about halfway up, and then it disappeared to the clouds, and somewhere looming over Paris is the top of the Eiffel Tower and the lookout platforms, but they transcended even my point of view. They went up into the clouds and beyond, and we can talk about a kind of, so just to the extent that the Eiffel Tower platform, you know, transcends the ground below it, it is to just that extent also not present to the ground below it. So that every measure of transcendence is also an additional measure of distance and remoteness and far offness. And I think the temptation is to take some kind of conception like that. And when we talk about the transcendence of God, we almost get this distance notion that needs somehow, if he's going to be with me, if he's going to be near me. And we've seen this in recent theology. It's not just the layperson that thinks this, but even theologians who probably should know better have tried to argue that God in himself as ase, and in a previous discussion we've talked about his aseity, and as simple and as immutable and as impassible and all the things classical theism says that God is and all the things that Protestants of every stripe once upon a time used to say that God is, and things that they should still say that God is. When we take these doctrines, it seems like how could an immutable God be meaningfully near to me, a mutable creature? Wouldn't God, to be meaningfully near to me, himself need to be mutable? Wouldn't God, in order to really care about me, need to himself be passible, that is to say, able to suffer, able to be affected and change. I mean, if Matthew has a burden that he's bearing, and then Andrew's going to come alongside and encourage him, there's a certain sense in which you're going to need to be able to sympathize with him and feel his pain and get to know his situation. And if that's how it is with you, then shouldn't God's nearness in a certain sense be established in the same way? But if he's impassible, immutable, not temporal, et cetera, then it would seem like what we need is we would need an immanence that is actually designed to correct classical theism. Now, there are ways to go about this. One proposal that came out in recent years was that we affirm everything that classical theism says about God, that he's outside of time and simple and eternal and impassible. We say all those things, but then we also recognize that as such, in so much as he is those things that we say he is, he can't be near us, and therefore he needs to assume or take to himself a set of properties, and this was the proposal that was offered, a set of properties by which he can, in a certain sense, establish himself with us. So the title of the book was God with Us, and the objective of the book was to say that the God of classical theism can't be as such God with us, and therefore we won't get rid of classical theism, but we'll supplement it with a set of properties that can then establish immanence. And this was a book that has ruffled some feathers, and deservedly so, because it's playing on this whole antithesis of, as classical theism describes him, God is transcendence. Therefore, classical theism may all be well and good, but what we need is something else. We need another set of properties in order to negotiate a nearness with us as well.
If I think I'm following you, they use the, I guess, Christology as the model by which they brought that in. And I mean, how would transcendence and immanence relate to Christology? We have a divine human all in the person of Christ. And how can you speak to that? Like,
the incommensurable metaphysical distance between God and the creature is not bridged by the incarnation. So that when we say that the Son is true God and true man, we should not think of Christ as establishing a metaphysical commensurability between the uncreated and the created. Rather, what we should say is that he is uncreated in his divinity, and he is creature insofar as he assumes a created nature into union with his person. But what I don't want to think about in terms of the incarnation is as the incarnation as bridging the transcendence of God over the world in terms of his being and glory. It's not what it's actually doing is it's repairing a not a metaphysical breach. That is an infinite distance that cannot be crossed. It's repairing a moral and a spiritual breach in which we, God's creatures made in his image, have been alienated from the joy of his presence and of his favor due to sin. So that the incarnation is not bridging the distance between God and the creature as creature. It's bridging the distance between God and the creature as sinner. And I think we need to keep, I think one way to avoid using the incarnation as a kind of mechanism for abridging the creator-creature distinction, which it doesn't. In a certain sense, I don't know the right way to say this. Christ as incarnated doesn't bridge the creator-creature distinction. The creator-creature distinction is in him as incarnated. So that true God and true man in one person are actually Christ is both at the same time, so that there's not an abridgment of the creator-creature distinction. There's really, this is the wrong word, but I'll use it anyway, there's an instantiation of the creator-creature distinction in the one person in his incarnate mode.
Could we say it proves the compatibility of the two concepts, maybe?
Yeah, that's an interesting line of thought that some theologians have chased down that I think is really fruitful, which is to say, to be God and to be man, in so much as they are not both realities of the same order of being, are not necessarily in mutually exclusive competition with each other. Mm. For one person to be true God and true man is not incompatible, but it would be incompatible for one person to be a true man and a true sheep, for instance. Because there you're talking about natures that exist within the same order of being and are actually distinguished from each other as items within a single order of being, so that you can't have one person who is true man and true sheep. I mean, you could have like a mythological creature, I suppose. It's like a fawn that's a half man, but you know, these are the sort of the thoughts of men's imaginations. But with regard to being true God, does being God mean not man? Not necessarily. And the point isn't that, well, maybe God's just a man after all. That's not the point at all. The point is that the way God is God is not by definition over and against creatures. Creatures are defined over and against each other. We are specified in our distinctions inside of genus from each other, but God doesn't exist inside of a genus. I mean, the way that God transcends creatures is not as within a category of being, but by transcending all categorical being. But if the one who transcends all categorical being assumes into personal union with himself a categorical being, let's just say a rational animal, a human nature, there's nothing that may be mysterious and that may be unique and that may be unprecedented, but it's not metaphysically absurd or impossible. Because to be God doesn't mean to not be man, whereas to be man means to not be any other categorical kind of being. But here's the thing, God isn't a categorical kind of being. And so, to your point, that maybe Andrew, maybe that's getting farther down into the weeds than you were anticipating. But
that's great.
That thread has been, the thread you pulled has been pulled, and I think fruitfully demonstrating that there is no, there's metaphysical strangeness, no doubt, in the incarnation, but not a metaphysical incompatibility or absurdity necessarily, just mystery. But I do think what we should emphasize with the incarnation is that the incarnation is not to abridge the distance between God and creatures as creatures, but the distance between God and man as sinner. It really is a salvific abridgment, not an ontological abridgment that's going on in the incarnation.
No, that's really helpful.
I'm struggling to keep up. It's so good. I read a few articles just before coming into this call with you on transcendence and immanence, and each time I read it, it just put it as two competing categories. And so to come in here and be essentially told it's like the same thing, I've got to reassess my reading.
Well, Toby, you are right, though, that they are conceptually distinct. Yeah. I mean, that isn't if the articles you read were making the point that conceptually these are distinct, in terms of how we define them, that's certainly correct.
They were surface level, so I'm sure they were. But to dive down below the surface, it's Christianity is a wonderful thing. It just always keeps getting deeper and deeper. Does this get into the topic of ad extra and ad intra?
I think actually that's a category mistake that is often made. So we don't want to say that God on extra is immanent and God on intra is transcendent, or vice versa. Actually, I want to say that God on extra, or God, some will say God pro nobis, God for us, is, I want to say both transcendent. So theologians, they just use funny Latin phrases, God in himself and God for us, or God in se and God pro nobis, if you want to sound fancy about it. But okay, they're the same thing. What we're saying, God in himself, I want to say that actually God in se, God in himself, is not transcendent or immanent. That is to say, God in himself is simple. God in himself is wise. God in himself is just. But God in himself doesn't have the relation of creator to himself. Does that make sense? So that there's a sense in which when I say transcendent and immanent, I'm really just identifying a relationship of God to creatures. So there's a real sense in which I don't want to make the distinction between transcendence and immanence something that I map on to the distinction between God in himself and God for us. I actually want to say that God is transcendent and immanent for us. Both. So they're both odd extra. They're two different ways of characterizing the same odd extra relationship. Yeah. Absolute creator, thereby transcending all creatures, and also thereby at one and the same moment filling heaven and earth and all creation with his power of making things be. And at that metaphysical level, they're identical. Even if at the conceptual level, I can't think them both at the same time and in the same respect, but I'm not saying that they aren't the same thing in God. I just can't conceive them as the same thing in my mind.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you. That's very helpful. You've touched on how this interacts with some other doctrines, like the incarnation and things like that. Is there any other big concepts that these doctrines play with or interact with?
Yeah, I think I think maybe I'll just circle back to the question a minute ago that I raised with regard to whether the God of classical theism needs some kind of mediating set of properties in order to be near his own creation. And I think it interacts specifically with the doctrine of God as creator. Christians, and when I say Christians now, I don't mean Western Christians, Protestant Christians, Catholic Christians. I mean basically Christian ever, hold a doctrine of creation in which God is the immediate creator of all things. And this really bears on this with regard to transcendence and immanence. If you have a view of God as transcendent, but you, as it were, bifurcate that from your conception of God as creator, so that God is transcendent, can't, as he is transcendent, be the immediate creator of all things. If creation is a mediated act of God as opposed to an immediate action of God in the world, then you do run into some difficulties. Then you do have a kind of God far off who needs to come up with some kind of metaphysical mechanism by which to get near to his own creation. But historically, Christianity has insisted with its doctrine of creation ex nihilo, which is a doctrine of immediate creation, that is to say, by immediate creation, I don't mean to say that there isn't development in the created order. I'm not talking about macroevolution, but even at the level of creatures making artifacts, you know, cabinets in your bedroom or something like this, I want to say that the way that God's the immediate creator of all things is most deeply with respect to the gift of esse. This is just a Latin word that needs to come back into our theological language. It's the infinitive form, to be, the act of to be. We might say the act of existence, but I like it more in the verbal, the act of to be. That even the cabinets in my bedroom, which receive their configuration from a cabinet maker, and which, you know, if you're walking through the forest, you don't stumble across a set of, you know, nicely sanded, stained cabinets just grow, you know, there's an oak tree and there's a willow tree, and then, you know, and look, there's a cabinet. It's not an item you find in nature. It's an item that results from the imposition of form by a fashioner on something you find in nature. So how can I say God's the creator of these things? I mean, if you look around the room in which you're sitting, or in which most of our listeners might be sitting right now, or the car they're driving in, most of the things around you, unless you're looking out the window at the hillside or something, are artifacts. They are material things that have form imposed upon them by human artificers. But then, is God the creator of those things? And we should still insist that yes, he is, because what God gives those things, even independent of those artists who make them, so to speak, is the act of existence itself. He's the giver of esse. Right now, I don't know if the person who built the cabinets in my house is alive or dead. I have no idea. I bought the house pre-existing, and I don't know who made them or where they came from. But I do know this, but the cabinet exists, and it's in the room with me. And the question is, what's making that so? Or better asked, who is making that so? So there's a sense in which creation and sustenance, this immediate power of God by which he makes all things be, whether they are natural forms or artificial forms, whether they are found in nature or found as the result of human industry. In either case, God is the giver of esse. He's the giver of to be. And he doesn't mediate the gift of to be. This is his own proper effect. I can give form to things, but I can't give existence to things in the proper sense. I can go to a set of logs. I can go to a sawmill, and I can cut trees into planks and begin to manipulate the material. But I can't make the material be as such. I can just make it be this or that way. I can give it form, but I can't give it the act of existence. And this is God's universal presence to creation. He is universally present in all things as the immediate cause of the being of all things. And that goes from the highest archangel right down to the little foam covers on the top of our microphones. Silly artifact that is. I mean, just the whole gamut of anything that isn't its own act of existence, which is to say every creature, which is not I am, but has its existence given to it as a gift, every creature depends immediately upon the power of God making it be. And I think this doctrine, Toby, to your question, what other doctrines does this interface with and how? The doctrine of creation ex nihilo and the doctrine of and the aspect of creation being immediate, not mediated, but mediate, this in itself removes this whole notion that the God of classical theism is a God far off that needs to be, as it were, have his presence mediated to us by a series of something else. Call them covenantal properties or whatever you like, what theologians have named them in recent years, that he needs something beside his divine nature to, in fact, mediate the presence of his divine nature to his own creation. That makes sense in a Neoplatonic cosmology. That makes sense if your God is not the immediate creator of all things. And then in the case of Plotinus, the one who is the source of the world is a God, definitely a God far off. He's the source of all things, but he's not the immediate creator of the material world. And if he's going to be near the material world, it's going to have to be through a series of demiurgic powers that run interference between God, who for Plotinus is simple, eternal, and immutable, etc. But his simple, eternal, immutable God is not the immediate creator of the material world. And therefore, you do have a transcendence. You have transcendence, but for him, transcendence is a problem.
Yeah.
It's because you don't have immediate creation, he's got to explain how the cause of all things could in any way be near things. And he proposes a series of mediators. He calls them demiurges. What's fascinating to me is that some Protestant Reformed theologians, even conservative ones, generally speaking, have proposed something similar to this in terms of their own cosmology, that God, like as he might be in Westminster Confession chapter 2, you know, without body, parts, or passions, that God as such couldn't be meaningfully near us unless he took on a whole set of properties entirely unlike those properties in order to meaningfully mediate his own presence. So now you're back to the old immanence correcting the problem of transcendence. And this is a kind of dualistic approach where you don't deny the transcendence, That would be one. I mean, that would be how certain idolaters might solve the problem. You continue to say, I believe in everything classical theism says, but you reconceive it all as a problem that needs a mechanism of abridgment now. And so now immanence is really God can't be immanent as simple. He can't be immanent as immutable. And so to be near us, he can't be near us as the unchangeable one. To be meaningfully near us would require him to be, you know, if I'm changing and God is near me, then God's got to change too in order to be meaningfully near me. So then you've got to have a covenantal property or some kind of other property beside the divine nature that establishes the mutability or the spatialness or the temporality or whatever else you think is needed for God to be near you. And I want to say his nearness is, that's how creatures are near creatures. The way God is near creatures is as the one who makes creatures be as their immediate cause of being. And that's a nearness. That's a nearness that is actually more interior and infinitely more infinite than the nearness of a mutable temporal, yea, even spatial being would be. So I think what I really want to connect it here, Toby, is with the doctrine of immediate creation. I think if we try to talk about transcendence and immanence, but we talk about it untethered from a consciousness of immediate creatorhood, then the problems are going to start coming into our God talk.
Mm. James, real quick, how have some erred on the side of transcendence and how have others erred on the side of immanence? Obviously, much more of the latter than the former recently.
I mean, I think on the side of erring on the side of a transcendence, you can do that in a couple of ways. Classically, at least in the modern era, deism would be one way to do it. The other way to err on the side of it is to think of transcendence, but divorce it from the notion of immediate creatorhood, and then you will necessarily think about it wrongly. You'll begin to think about it as a distance that requires an abridgment somehow. So those are ways to go wrong, and they're different ways. I mean, there are different ways to go wrong on the doctrine, but there are ways to go wrong on it. I think on the other side, in terms of immanence, one way to go wrong on it is to think of it, conversely, as a correction to transcendence, or as a supplement, maybe a better way to say it, a supplement to transcendence, or even worse, would be a doctrine like what you have in something like open theism or process theism, where you relativize the transcendence itself down within the order of changing realities. And so you have, in the case of, and I'll give you an example, in the case of someone like Alfred North Whitehead, who was a great early 20th century British process philosopher. I say great in the sense of really a powerful thinker, deeply wrong theologically and also philosophically, but nevertheless, there's genius there, even if it's madness. in my judgment. And he would see God as what he calls dipolar. And later on, Charles Hartshorne is going to pick this up for process theologians, where there's this kind of absolute pole of God, but the absolute pole of God's being is God far off and unrelated. And so there's the other pole of God's being, which is the pole of God's being that sort of corrects that gets him near to me, in which he's undergoing change. I think you also get this with regard to kind of divine temporalism, where for God to be meaningfully near me, he's got to exist in time and therefore can't exist outside of time. So now immanence is not so much supplementing transcendence as dissolving it. That would be another way in which if God's going to be near me, he can't transcend me. If he's going to transcend me, he can't be near me. Or the more conservative, wrong approach, he transcends me, but he supplements the transcendence with a nearness that offsets the liabilities. And I think that also should be avoided. And we should, but again, the question, how do I avoid making these mistakes? You have to root the whole thing on immediate creation. As soon as you do that, you'll be left with the mystery of creation, I grant. But all the problems of transcendence and the problems of immanence are going to disappear. You'll be left with the mystery of the creator-creature relation. But the problematic elements that now need correction will be removed from your theology.
No, thanks, James. I think immediate creation is just such a worshipful thought. I think I'm going to be at church Sunday morning looking at one of the chairs and thinking God is right then immediately creating it, and somehow the transcendence of God is real and working in our world, and it's just an incredible thing. So
He is here now among us as the transcendent one, not over and against His transcendence, but as transcendent. Yeah, and this James, this really should suffuse our worship.
Yeah,
amen. James, this has been great. We're so grateful every time you join us, and this has been really eye-opening on multiple levels. Really, really helpful. Listeners, like I and many others, listen to this twice or three times, and you'll continue to understand more and more and be blessed as you do. So we're real grateful that you'd join us, James, on another episode of No Lasting City. We look forward to all that the Lord will do in and through you as you continue to be a blessing to the church and all that you involve yourself in. And we would love for you to join us again sometime soon on No Lasting City Podcast. Well, thank you for coming.
I look forward to it, and I've enjoyed this time together.
Hey, thanks so much. We have too.
No Lasting City is a ministry of Riverbend Bible Church in Hastings, New Zealand. For more information, please visit our website, riverbend.org.nz, or visit us on YouTube. Follow us on social media where you can interact with us or ask us any questions. Our links are in the show notes, and we'd love to see you there.